Numbers chapters 24 and 25. The 12th talk in a series on the narrative portions of Numbers was presented by David Crabtree on July 17, 2005 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2005. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
We'll be looking at Numbers chapter 24 and 25 today. My plan is to do those two chapters this Sunday, and then next Sunday I'm going to finish out the narrative portion of Numbers. There are only a couple more chapters in Numbers that are narrative. The rest of it is legislative. And I'm only doing the narrative portion, so we'll finish out Numbers. In chapter 24, what has preceded this is that Balak, who is the king of Moab, is looking out over the plains of Moab, and the Israelites are parked there. The Israelites are making their way from Egypt into Canaan, and this is the last place that they stay before they begin to move into Canaan. Balak is concerned about the fact that there are so many Israelites parked on his doorstep and what they might do to him and his people, that he calls in a seer from about 360 miles away, Balaam, to come and place a curse on the Israelites so that he will be able to defeat them so that they will not conquer the Moabites, his people. Balaam, though, after he is summoned to come, God puts him through an experience, and we talked last week about whether it was a dream or whether it really happened. In any case, it was an experience that made a deep impression upon him, in which it became clear to him that he needed to say only what God told him to say. He couldn't do any freelancing, no ad-libbing. He had to say exactly what God told him to say. Then he arrives in Moab, and Balak sets up on one hilltop 7 altars, offers 14 sacrifices. Balaam goes to another hilltop where he can look out over the Israelites and comes back with a word from God. And instead of a curse on the Israelites, it turns out to be a blessing on the Israelites. So they move hilltops, go to another hilltop where they try this all again, the 7 altars, 14 sacrifices. Balaam goes to another hilltop, comes back, and the second time he proclaims blessings rather than curses on the people of Israel. So it's at that point then that we pick up the action in chapter 24. Actually, we're going to start with the very end of 23. I didn't finish that. 27, and I'll read through verse 9 of 24. Then Balak said to Balaam, "Please come, I will take you to another place. Perhaps it will be agreeable with God that you curse them for me from there." So Balak took Balaam to the top of Peor, which overlooks the wasteland. And Balaam said to Balak, "Build 7 altars for me here, and prepare 7 bulls and 7 rams for me here." And Balak did just as Balaam had said, and offered up a bull and a ram on each altar. When Balaam saw that it pleased the Lord to bless Israel, he did not go, as at other times, to seek omens, but he set his face toward the wilderness. And Balaam lifted up his eyes and saw Israel camping tribe by tribe, and the Spirit of God came upon him. And he took up his discourse and said, "The oracle of Balaam, the son of Beor, and the oracle of the man whose eye is opened, the oracle of him who hears the words of God, who sees the vision of the Almighty, falling down, yet having his eyes uncovered. How fair are your tents, O Jacob, your dwellings, O Israel, like valleys that stretch out, like gardens beside the river, like aloes planted by the Lord, like cedars beside the waters. Water shall flow from his buckets, and his seed shall be by many waters, and his king shall be higher than Agag, and his kingdom shall be exalted. God brings him out of Egypt. He is for him like the horns of the wild ox. He shall devour the nations who are his adversaries, and shall crush their bones in pieces, and shatter them with his arrows. He couches, he lies down as a lion, and as a lion, who dares rouse him? Blessed is everyone who blesses you, and cursed is everyone who curses you. So Balak, being given over to technique, as I talked about last time, he figures that it's just a matter of finding the right method. They haven't been doing it quite right. So we're going to move to another hilltop and try it the third time. So this is at Balak's initiative. But Balaam seems to be on board with this. And he instructs him to set up the 7 altars once again and to offer the sacrifices. But this time, there are several things that are different about how it works out. First of all, Balaam doesn't go to another hilltop like he has before. He just stays put. Then secondly, he doesn't receive omens. He doesn't even try to receive omens. He faces the wilderness, and then it says that the Spirit of God came upon him. So apparently what's happened this time, the way that he's received this message from God is different. I don't know how it's different, but presumably there's something qualitatively different about the way that he's received the message this time. Then he proclaims this third oracle. He starts out in the first 2 verses of the oracle just establishing who he is and who this oracle is coming from. And it's indicating that he is one who sees, which is ironic because earlier in the story of Balaam and the donkey, he was the one who didn't see. It was the donkey that was the one that saw. But here Balaam is one who sees. He's got clarity. He can tell. He sees what God sees. In the last line, it says, falling down, yet having his eyes uncovered. It's not clear what it means when it says that he is falling down. I assume that this means that he is prostrate before God, that he understands that he is subservient to this God who is giving him the message. So in that sense, he is falling down. He's prostrate. Yet, having his eyes uncovered. So he's subservient in one sense, but he's privileged in another sense, in that he has received this the ability to see from God. So now when Balaam looks out at the Israelites, if you recall back to Balak, when he looked out at the Israelites, what he saw looked to him like a plague. He said it was like they covered the ground like the locusts. So it was an ominous sight. They were consuming all of the pasture land. And it was a sight that caused him fear and concern. Balaam now, his eyes open, looks at these same tents and sees it very differently. Rather than looking like a plague, it says, how fair are your tents, O Jacob, your dwellings, O Israel. So his response is positive. This looks good. This looks promising. He goes on and likens it to valleys that stretch out, gardens beside the river, aloes planted by the Lord, cedars beside the waters. These are all positive images, especially for people who live in the desert. It's indicative of water and life and growth, all things that are scarce in the desert. So his looking at it through God's eyes, what he sees is a very good thing, a very promising thing. Furthermore, water shall flow from his buckets. So here it's overflowing with that which provides life. It's full of life, full of vitality. And his king shall be higher than Agag, and his kingdom shall be exalted. It's not clear what this reference is. Agag only shows up one other place in the Old Testament. There's an Agag who is a king of the Amalekites who is defeated during the time of Saul. So in a period of time about between 200 and 400 years after this is written, there is an Agag that is defeated by Saul. but he's the king of the Amalekites, not a particularly prominent individual. If that's who this is referring to, then it is prophetic of the defeat of that Amalekite. Then, let's see. I'm going to proceed through the oracle, and I'll come back to verse 7 in just a second. Verse 8 then refers back to God's role in bringing the Israelites out of Egypt, a very prominent theme. That God, it was through God's power that the Israelites came out of Egypt, and God did it in a very overt fashion and powerful way. And it is with God's power and guidance then that Israel shall devour the nations who are his adversaries, and shall crush their bones in pieces and shatter them with his arrows. So predictive of Israel's continued success as Israel goes in to take the promised land. Then verse 9 likens Israel to a lion. He couches, he lies down as a lion, and as a lion, who dares rouse him? But if anyone can see, they should be able to see that Israel is not to be messed with, because God has his hand on Israel, is guiding them and protecting them. And then the last couplet in verse 9, blessed is everyone who blesses you, and cursed is everyone who curses you. That's the very thing that God had said to Abraham when he had first appeared to Abraham, that God would bless everyone who blesses Abraham and curse everyone who curses Abraham. So this is a continuation of this promise by God to Abraham and his descendants, which is interesting because the reason that Balak had selected Balaam as the seer that he would invite down to curse the Israelites was because he said, everyone who Balaam curses is cursed, and everyone who Balaam blesses is blessed. And yet that has been reversed. I mean, Balaam doesn't have that kind of independent power, but in fact he has been forced by God to place a blessing on the people of Israel, and in fact that blessing is consonant with God's blessing on them. So that's the third oracle. It's the most positive of the three oracles. And once again, essentially it pronounces a blessing on the people of Israel rather than a curse. Now, let me digress just a little bit. Verse 7 reads very differently in the Septuagint. Now, let me explain what the Septuagint is and why that's significant. All of this is information that I think is helpful for you as students of the Bible. It's important for you to know about in studying the Old Testament, and it's important for you in studying the New Testament as well. The Old Testament text, according to tradition, was written by various prophets. The first five books were written by Moses. Other books were written by other prophets, and they were passed down through the years. Some of them written, Moses lived, depending on your chronology, whether it's 1400 or 1200, but he lived over 1,000 years B.C. The other prophets lived in other times up to about 500 B.C. So all of the books were written before about 500 B.C. of the Old Testament. Any copies of those books were done by hand. There was no way of mass producing documents in ancient times. So the only way that they could be copied would be to be copied by hand. In the process of copying documents by hand, it's not uncommon for there to be discrepancies that develop between the various manuscripts. And by the time of Jesus, we know that there were various genealogical lines of texts. And what I mean by that is if we have two texts copied from one text, and there's a change made in one of these, then that change is likely to be duplicated in those that follow from it. It's not likely to be duplicated in the ones that followed from the other side. So it's kind of like a family tree in the way that these texts pass down any changes that are made in the text itself. So there are several families that are current at the time of Jesus. We have found enough pieces of manuscripts to know that there are several different genealogical lines that existed at the time of Jesus. Now, there's one very important text called the Septuagint that was created about 200 or 300 BC. According to tradition, you can read about this in Josephus, he talks about this. There was a library that was built using the money of the Ptolemy family, which is a Greek family that came into control of Egypt after Alexander the Great. Using Ptolemy money, a library was built in Alexandria. Alexandria was established by Alexander the Great. It became one of the most prominent cities in the Mesopotamian world. They had a big library there, and one of the projects was to bring significant texts from all over the known world and collect them in this library. So it became a very significant place of study and culture and intellectual life. As a part of this project, apparently, there was an effort to translate the Old Testament, the Jewish scriptures, into Greek. And so the Old Testament text was translated into Greek. According to tradition, there were 70 people that worked on the translation. And that's why it's called the Septuagint, Septuagint meaning 70. So this is a Greek translation of the Old Testament, the Hebrew Old Testament, into Greek. Now the Septuagint, and so the symbol that's often used for the Septuagint is LXX, which is Roman numeral for 70. Now the Septuagint then becomes one of the major versions of the Old Testament. There is another version of the Old Testament that comes into being at about 500 AD. There are a group of Jewish scholars who are concerned about the preservation of the text in its pure form. They're called the Masoretes. They do a great deal of work trying to get the text in its pure form and then figure out ways of preserving it in that pure form. And they become very meticulous in the way that they copy the manuscript so that there will not be errors that creep into them. That text that they develop becomes known as the Masoretic text. And one copy of that text made its way to a monastery in the Sinai Peninsula at Mount Sinai. It was an Orthodox monastery that came into possession of a codex in which that was a representative of this particular the Masoretic text. And they ran into financial difficulties, and the Tsar of Russia, a good Orthodox Christian, gave them a lot of money to overcome their financial difficulties, and in exchange they presented the Tsar with a gift of this dusty manuscript that had not been used. I don't even know if they knew of the significance of this manuscript, but it was given to the Tsar of Russia. He took it back home, and has been studied by scholars and has been determined to be the best representative of the Masoretic text. And it is now in St. Petersburg in a museum there. So, your Old Testament in your Bible, in all the versions that I'm aware of, is the English translation of the Masoretic text, largely based on this codex that's sitting in a museum in St. Petersburg. Okay, so that's the Masoretic text. It's considered to be the best, by scholars, it's considered to be the best, purest form of the Old Testament Hebrew text. The Septuagint differs with it on a number of occasions, and I don't know how many, I haven't counted, I would just be guessing, but I would guess on thousands of occasions, differs significantly, at least in hundreds of instances, from the Masoretic text. And verse 7 is one of those instances where it differs significantly. Let me read a translation of the Septuagint let me read verse 7 and the way it would read in the Septuagint. Water shall flow from his buckets, and his seed shall be by many waters. A man shall issue from his seed, and he shall have dominion over many nations, and he shall be higher than the kingdom of Gog, and his kingdom shall be exalted. Significantly different, and has a messianic tone to it. I mean, it could be predictive of the Messiah. In general, the Septuagint, in where it varies from the Masoretic text, it is not uncommon for it to have a more messianic tone to it, but the changes are of a messianic nature. Why? I don't know. I mean, I don't know whether the Septuagint is actually a better representative of the Old Testament text, or whether we know that there was a heightened sense in the Jewish world in the 3rd, 2nd, and 1st centuries B.C., an anticipation towards the Messiah. Maybe that influenced the way it was translated. But it's hard to see how these words in the Septuagint could have come from the same text as the Masoretic text. It is interesting to me that in the New Testament, the times that I've looked up quotations from the Old Testament, usually the quotation is from the Septuagint. And how do we account for that? Well, we could account for it because it was the Greek translation and the New Testament is being written in Greek, so they use the Greek translation. That's possible. But it's also possible that the New Testament writers had confidence in that translation. So that's thinking about the Septuagint and its role in the New Testament, I think, would be an interesting research project that I do not have time for right now. Okay, so that's the end of my digression. Balak's response in verses 10 through 14. Then Balak's anger burned against Balaam, and he struck his hands together. And Balak said to Balaam, I called you to curse my enemies, but behold, you have persisted in blessing them these three times. Therefore, flee from your place now. I said I would honor you greatly, but behold, the Lord has held you back from honor. And Balaam said to Balak, did I not tell your messengers, whom you had sent to me, saying, though Balak were to give me his house full of silver and gold, I could not do anything contrary to the command of the Lord, either good or bad, of my own accord. What the Lord speaks, that I will speak. And now behold, I am going to my people. Come, and I will advise you what these people will do to your people in the days to come. So Balak is just beside himself, and he strikes his hands together, and apparently that's an expression of frustration or disgust of some sort. He's just beside himself. Balaam, three times now, rather than cursing Israel as he was hired to do, has ended up blessing Israel. Balak is frustrated to no end. And he says, get out of here. And presumably it's because Balak is so upset, he's afraid he will do something rash with respect to Balaam, that he might strike Balaam himself. He wants Balaam to leave. All of this is ironic in light of the previous story about Balaam and the donkey. Because in that instance, three times the donkey would not obey Balaam's commands to proceed forward because the angel of the Lord was standing there with his sword. The donkey could see it, but Balaam could not. And Balaam got increasingly frustrated, and at the end was to the place where he says he would have killed the donkey. He was on the verge of killing the donkey because of his frustration. Balaam's response is, I had no option. I couldn't do otherwise. And I told you that before. I told your messengers that I could only say what God had me say. I could do no otherwise, good or bad. And Balaam has fulfilled that. And Balaam says, now I will leave, I'll go home. But first, let me tell you what's going to happen. And so now he enters into a fourth oracle, and this one is the most prophetic of the oracles, starting with verse 15. And he took up his discourse and said, the oracle of Balaam, the son of Beor, and the oracle of the man whose eye is opened, the oracle of him who hears the words of God and knows the knowledge of the Most High, who sees the vision of the Almighty, falling down, yet having his eyes uncovered. I see him, but not now. I behold him, but not near. A star shall come forth from Jacob, and a scepter shall rise from Israel, and shall crush through the forehead of Moab, and tear down all the sons of Sheph. And Edom shall be a possession. Seir, its enemies, also shall be a possession, while Israel performs valiantly. One from Jacob shall have dominion and shall destroy the remnant from the city. And he looked at Amalek and took up his discourse and said, Amalek was the first of the nations, but his end shall be destruction. And he looked at the Kenite and took up his discourse and said, your dwelling place is enduring and your nest is set in the cliff. Nevertheless, Cain shall be consumed. How long shall Asher keep you captive? And he took up his discourse and said, alas, who can live except God has ordained it? But ships shall come from the coast of Kittim, and they shall afflict Asher, and shall afflict Eber. So they shall come to destruction. Then Balaam arose and departed and returned to his place. And Balak also went his way. So this is the longest and most prophetic of the four oracles that he proclaims. It starts out just the same as the previous oracle, with only the addition of the line, and knows the knowledge of the Most High. Otherwise, it's identical to the beginning of the third oracle. Then he says, I see him, but not now. I behold him, but not near. So he's talking about something that's in the future, something that's yet to come. He talks about a star coming forth from Jacob and a scepter shall rise from Israel. So there will come a time when this something will arise out of Israel that will provide leadership. And through this leadership, Israel will defeat a number of its enemies. The first one it talks about is Moab. Moab is the people of which Balak is the king. And they have resisted the people of Israel coming through their territory. And because of their resistance to that, Moab will be crushed through the forehead. And tear down all of the sons of Sheth. It is believed that Sheth refers to a tribe that inhabited the area of Canaan, and may have been somehow related to the Moabites. So this is a prediction of the destruction of those two peoples. Then Edom. Edom, as you will recall earlier in Numbers, by the instructions of God, the Israelites had asked permission to pass through Edom. They said, we won't graze your land. We won't take anything from you without paying you for it. We're just passing through. Please let us go through. And the Edomites said no. So apparently, in response to that then, God is going to make Edom a possession of Israel. And Seir is another name for Edom. Then next, in verse 20, the Amalekites. The Amalekites also had, they're the ones that had attacked Israel. I hope I'm getting this right. They're the ones that had attacked Israel and taken some, kidnapped some Israelites, God led the Israelites in a counterattack on them. And it says, Amalek was the first of the nations, but his end shall be destruction. So their destruction is also predicted here. So here are three peoples that had stood in the way of Israel making their way to the promised land, and each of them will be punished by God. That's what's being predicted. The next is the Kenites, and that's the most mysterious one, because the Kenites have not been mentioned previously, and in fact, later on in the Old Testament, there are some instances in which the Kenites become friends with the Israelites. But nevertheless, here is what is predicted. Your dwelling place is enduring, and your nest is set in the cliff. Nevertheless, Cain, and it's assumed that that's related to the Kenites, probably the progenitor of the Kenites, Cain shall be consumed. How long shall Asher keep you captive? So what apparently is predicted here is that the Kenites too will be defeated and they will be taken captive. Now, it says, how long shall Asher keep you captive? That would apparently be a reference to the Assyrians. That doesn't work very well historically. So it's possible that what this should read is the Asherim. There is a tribe of Canaanites called the Asherim. And apparently there is evidence that the Asherim did defeat the Kenites. So that seems to be the more likely reading here. In any case, the Kenites will be defeated and taken captive. Then he concludes it with this last piece. Alas, who shall live except God has ordained it? Then he predicts that ships will come from the coast of Kittim. Kittim usually refers to Crete. It's an island in the Mediterranean. And so if it's referring to Crete, it's referring to some Hellenic peoples. The Crete at that time would have been inhabited by people that are related to those people who settle in Greece. So ships are going to come from Kittim, and they shall afflict Asher. And once again, this must be referenced to the Asherim inside the promised land. And shall afflict Eber. And that apparently is, that also is assumed to be a tribe within Canaan. So this is predicting the coming of ships with from Kittim, conquering some peoples who are living in the promised land in Canaan. Now that's interesting because we know historically that there were ships that came from Crete and elsewhere in the Mediterranean and attacked the eastern Mediterranean coast from Egypt all the way up Palestine and into Lebanon. And that happens about between 1,200 and 1,000. And it's a group of tribes, the most prominent of which is called the Pelashti. The Pelashti attack the coast of Canaan, and they also attack into Egypt. By some accounts, they attacked Egypt, were with difficulty defeated by the Egyptians, and the Egyptians moved them, had them planted on the coast of Canaan. But in any case, they ended up settling on the coast of Canaan. And since their name was Pelashti, and because they had connections with the Greek world, in the Greek world they began to refer to that part of the coast of the Mediterranean as the land of the Pelashti, or it came to be known as Palestine. So that's where we get the word Palestine, and that's where we get the name in the Old Testament, Philistines. It's these Pelashti, these Hellenic peoples that settle on the coast of Canaan. They absorb Canaanite culture, and become virtually indistinguishable from Canaanite culture, but they are a Greek people, and they become known as the Philistines. So this apparently is predicting that event, the coming of the Philistines. But then the last line, so they also shall come to destruction. Interesting, because what it's pointing out is just because God uses a people as a tool for punishing someone else, that doesn't mean that this tool of punishment is necessarily privileged. This tool of punishment is subject to the punishment of God as well. And I think that's what it means when it starts out this section in verse 23, alas, who can live except God has ordained it? That things will go as God has ordained. So that's the oracle. That's the fourth oracle that God then proclaims. And it has several predictive elements in which those people who have stood in the way of Israel will be punished. It concludes then and says that Balaam arose and departed and returned to his place. It's not clear what it means by his place, whether he went home or whether he went someplace else, but we'll come back to that next week. And Balak also went his way. So that concludes then the story of Balaam and Balak. I don't think Balak occurs anymore in Numbers. There are two references to Balaam, and we'll talk about those next week. Okay, following right on the heels of that is another incident, which I think is particularly curious. The first 9 verses. While Israel remained at Shittim, the people began to play the harlot with the daughters of Moab, for they invited the people to the sacrifices of their gods, and the people ate and bowed down to their gods. So Israel joined themselves to Baal of Peor. And the Lord was angry against Israel. And the Lord said to Moses, take all the leaders of the people and execute them in broad daylight before the Lord, so that the fierce anger of the Lord may turn away from Israel. So Moses said to the judges of Israel, each of you slay his men who have joined themselves to Baal of Peor. Then behold, one of the sons of Israel came and brought to his relatives a Midianite woman in the sight of Moses and in the sight of all the congregation of the sons of Israel while they were weeping at the doorway of the tent of meeting. When Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron the priest, saw it, he arose from the midst of the congregation and took a spear in his hand, and he went after the man of Israel into the tent and pierced both of them through, the man of Israel and the woman, through the body. So the plague on the sons of Israel was checked, and those who died by the plague were 24,000. There's no indication how long in time these two events are separated, between the time of this activity with Balaam and Balak and this activity going on in the plain. We don't know how long the Israelites have been on the plain before this begins to happen. But in any case, what does happen is the Moabites begin to have interactions with the Israelites. And I don't know whether they're trading with one another, whether it's initially economic or exactly how it gets started, but they begin to have interaction. And it says the people began to play harlot with the daughters of Moab. Now, play harlot, I think here is being used in a religious sense, that the people of Israel began to be faithless towards God and began to worship the gods of Moab. So they're having interaction. And in fact, there are indications here that the men of Israel, at least, are sexually involved with the Moabite women. And it comes to the place where they're actually worshiping the gods of Moab. And so God becomes angry with Israel. And that's what it says in verse 3. It doesn't make clear until much later that the form that anger took was that God sent a plague on Israel, a plague that takes the life of 24,000 people. But at this point in the text, it's not making clear exactly the form that God's anger took. So God comes to Moses, and what he says is, take all of the leaders of Israel out and into broad daylight and execute them. Now, the verb that's used here to execute them, there are various speculations as to what kind of execution that is prescribing, some of them particularly gruesome. But that's all speculation. It's not clear what form this execution was supposed to take. But God says, take them out and execute them in public. Interestingly, then, and that's, it's not clear to me what God is thinking there. Presumably, he's holding the leaders responsible for the people's faithlessness. That because they're in a position of leadership, they have a responsibility to stand up against the faithlessness of the Israelite people. So presumably that's the logic behind it. And they have not done that, fulfilled that responsibility. In any case, what Moses then does is different. And that's curious. Moses said to the judges of Israel, and the judges presumably are the leaders of Israel. Moses said to the judges of Israel, each of you slay his men who have joined themselves to Baal of Peor. So what Moses says is, you leaders go out and identify those who have committed the wrongdoing, and you kill them. Now, it's not clear to me whether Moses was in the right in this change or whether he was not in the right in this change. It is imaginable to me that God could give a command that in the circumstance needs to be modified in the way that it's carried out. That is conceivable to me. Because I'm thinking along the analogy of me as a parent telling my child something that I want my child to do. But as my child goes to carry out that command, the circumstances are different from what were originally envisioned when the command was given, such that it needs to be carried out differently. I should have spent some time thinking about an example before I stood up here, because I'm terrible at thinking of examples on the spot, so I won't give an example. But I suspect that you know the phenomenon, that there are times when you as a parent have told a child to do something that really needed to be done differently because the circumstances were a little different than envisioned. And you expect them then to make those changes according to you, the parents' values. In other words, you expect them to act as you as a parent would want them to act, even though it may not be exactly the way that you had told them to act. I don't know if that's what's happening here or not, but that is imaginable to me. In any case, neither one of these is carried out. Neither what God said to do, nor what Moses said to do, because there's another event that takes place that supersedes both of those, and that's this event with Phinehas. They apparently are meeting in the tent of meeting, and the leaders of Israel are gathered there, and they're talking about this plague and what they're going to do. And while they're talking about this, there's an Israelite man shows up at the door of the tent with a Moabite woman. And they show up at the very time when it says they were weeping at the doorway of the tent of meeting. So when the people of Israel are weeping over this, These show up. So it is blatant rebelliousness that they are manifesting here. So Phinehas, one of the priests, grabs a spear, and it doesn't say where he gets it from or anything. He just grabs a spear and he chases after them. And it says that he went after the man of Israel into the tent, and it's not clear what the tent is. But apparently, It's not the same tent in which they're meeting. Apparently, the man of Israel and this it's a Midianite woman. The Midianite woman, they take off running. He chases after them into some tent, and I don't know what tent that is, and he runs both of them through, killing both of them. Once that happens, then, the plague on the sons of Israel was checked. So that the plague stops instantly once that action is taken. Okay. The rest of that chapter. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron, the priest, has turned away my wrath from the sons of Israel, in that he was jealous with my jealousy among them, so that I did not destroy the sons of Israel in my jealousy. Therefore say, Behold, I give him my covenant of peace, and it shall be for him and his descendants after him a covenant of a perpetual peace priesthood, because he was jealous for his God and made atonement for the sons of Israel. Now the name of the slain man of Israel, who is slain with the Midianite woman, was Zimri the son of Salu, a leader of a father's household among the Simeonites. And the name of the Midianite woman who was slain was Cozbi, the daughter of Zur, who was head of the people of a father's household in Midian. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, Be hostile to the Midianites and strike them, for they have been hostile to you with their tricks, with which they have deceived you in the affair of Peor, and in the affair of Cozbi, the daughter of the leader of Midian, their sister, who was slain on the day of the plague because of Peor. So God then commends Phinehas. And he says, He has turned away my wrath from the sons of Israel, in that he was jealous with my jealousy among them. So Phinehas acted with the same kind of zeal that God has in doing what he did, and is commended for that. And as a result, it says that I give him my covenant of peace, and it shall be for him and his descendants after him a covenant of a perpetual priesthood. Phinehas then becomes the line from which the high priest is drawn after this. Then the Bible names names, which is rather rare in the Old Testament, that wrongdoers are singled out and actually named with names. But in this case, both the name of the Israelite man and the name of the Midianite woman are recorded, both of them from prominent families. Then God says, Be hostile to the Midianites and strike them, for they have been hostile to you with their tricks, with which they have deceived you in the affair of Peor. So the Israelites are instructed to strike back at the Midianites, and that will happen. That will happen later on. And it says, because they have, they have been hostile to you with their tricks, and we will come back to that next week. What do they mean by the tricks? Okay. This is a very curious incident. I remember several years ago talking to a young man who was arguing that if we really were faithful towards God, we would go out into the city of Eugene and run through with a spear. He picked out as examples blatant homosexuals. This is a curious event here. It's hard to know how to think about Phinehas. But I think the way that we are to think about Phinehas is that Phinehas correctly understood the situation in which he found himself. That is, there were Israelites who were blatantly disobeying God. They were flaunting their rebelliousness. And Phinehas knew that that was the result, that was the cause of the plague that was inflicting the people of Israel. And here was a representative of that whole spirit that came and stood in front of the tent of meeting. And as a result, in that time, in that context, his thinking was, what would be appropriate and fitting with God's values to do at this moment? And decides that the correct thing to do would be to pick up a spear and kill them. That would not always be the right thing to do in the face of wrongdoing. And this is an interesting contrast to something like the woman caught in adultery that's brought to Jesus. Jesus does not pick up a spear and run her through. It's a very different setting. It's a very different time in history. It's a different culture. And it's a different circumstance. The whole context of that. There's another reason why she's being brought to him. It's not just for her wrongdoing. She doesn't have the same spirit that this Israelite man who appears before the tent of meeting has, etc. Jesus puts that all into context and chooses a very different course of action. As you will recall, he writes on the sand, and it's not clear what he wrote, but then he says, let he who is without sin throw the first stone to put her to death. At which case, the Pharisees walk away. So it's a very different set of circumstances. And in that set of circumstances, Jesus determines that the action that is fitting with God's values is very different than we have here in Numbers. That's one of the things that is curious about being a Christian. Everyone's life is trailblazing in the sense that no one has ever been in your shoes before. Your situation, your circumstances are different from those that have been faced by anyone in history or anyone that will come after us. So as we go through life, we are having to apply God's principles to situations that have never been faced before by a human being. So it's a pioneering effort that we have to go through. And it's a very challenging task to do that. But the principles, they are fixed. They are firm. They are unchanging. The only question is, as situations change, as the context in which those need to apply change, we have to figure out how to bring those principles to bear on our particular circumstances. And that's an art. And that's an art that is not easy. That's an art that we spend our lives trying to learn. But that's the challenge that's before us. We have no other choice. There will never be another person who will face the same circumstance that Phineas faced. Very, very briefly, these two sections fit together kind of strangely. Because on the one hand, the story of Balaam, what we see there is God's determination to bless his people, Israel, the Israelites. He is determined to bless them, and he is going to make sure that no one else infringes upon that blessing. He's determined to make that blessing come to pass. And he speaks up for their blamelessness on two different occasions, but most clearly in 23:21, in one of the oracles that Balaam pronounces, he says, he, referring back to God, he has not observed misfortune in Jacob, nor has he seen trouble in Israel. So God sees nothing curse-worthy in the Israelites. So he defends them throughout this section with Balaam. That is immediately followed by this section in which, once again, the Israelites are faithless. I mean, that has been a theme that we've seen from Exodus, all the way through Exodus, and we see it all the way through Numbers, that the people of Israel consistently, time after time, demonstrate their stubbornness, their complaining, and their faithlessness. And they never seem to get better. I mean, if you can measure that on some kind of scale, it's not clear that it becomes better as time goes on. And I think that the fact that it's happening here, right on the doorstep of Canaan, is significant. That they haven't made significant progress in becoming better, more faithful people. Why are they called blameless by God then? It must be based on something other than their faithfulness, their absolute obedience to God's word. And it must come from God chooses to not see them as blameless through his mercy and his grace. God disciplines them, however. It's not that he sees no fault in them. We've seen all along the way that God disciplines them, and he will continue to discipline them. But he doesn't curse them. He doesn't withdraw his blessing. It is interesting, however, that we have this incident recorded in which Phinehas puts to death these two rebels. So we do have emerging within the people of Israel some who share God's zeal. There are some who have come to appreciate God's values and adopt them as their own and to act them out. So although the people of Israel have not become significantly better, there are individuals within Israel who have embraced God's values and lived them out. I think all of this is analogous to what happens in us as believers. It has certainly been my experience that as I think about my rebelliousness towards God, I'm not sure that I have become significantly less rebellious as time goes on. That is so deep within me that in various ways it shows up in different contexts in my life. But what God does seem to be doing in my life is arousing my conscience such that I don't like that rebelliousness. I don't like the fact that I am a rebel and a sinner. And that wanting to be what God wants me to be is a hunger that is growing, and I hope it continues to grow. But that's what seems to change, rather than getting to be a better person. Not that there hasn't been some change, because I think there has been some change. But is there huge change, wholesale change? I haven't seen it in my life, and we don't see it here in the nation of Israel. Okay, I ran over maybe a couple questions. Oh, there are more than a couple hands. We'll see.
Okay. Are you taking the word plague in this chapter as a disease?
I am.
Like as in a physical disease?
I am.
The way the verses read to me, I was wondering if it could be that the plague is the moral disease, the disease of the children of Israel being joined to Baal. Because it's like putting the two side by side and reading them in that way, it seems to flow more smoothly. And
well, are you seeing people? Is people are dying?
Right.
What are they dying from?
The leaders killing them, like Moses told them to. Because of the moral plague.
Right.
That was
right. The word plague is not going to necessarily indicate disease. It's just going to be some kind of, but I have to think whether carrying out executions, I have to look and see whether carrying out executions could ever be described as a plague. You see what I'm saying?
Yes, but no, okay. But the carrying out the executions wouldn't necessarily be the plague. The plague would be the children of Israel being joined to the children of Baal, and then they're killed because of that plague. So like in verse 18, Cosby was killed in the day of the plague. Her killing was a result of that plague. And in verse 8, In verse 8, Phinehas kills the two people, and then it says, so the plague was stopped.
Mm-hmm.
And earlier, where Moses is telling the leaders to kill the people, like, it seems like Moses tells the leaders to kill the leaders go out and kill the people, and then verse 8 says, so the plague was stopped.
Mm-hmm.
And then in verse 9, like, I don't know, just the idea of a plague, it seems out of the blue.
It does.
Not really.
Mm-hmm. I'll look at that.
Okay.
That's interesting.
Two things. First of all, verse 4.
Of which chapter?
Sorry, 25. Mm-hmm. Chapter 25.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't seem to me that Moses was disobeying God when he said, he told the judges to go out and kill the disobedient ones that were under their jurisdiction. In verse 4, in my Bible, it says, take all the leaders of the people and hang the offenders before the Lord out in the sun. I don't see why that can't be interpreted like Moses is going to go take his posse of, you know, judges, and they're going to go together and do justice on the people.
Mm-hmm. What would be the antecedent of them in verse 4? And execute them. It would be the people. That's what you would be taking it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Is it grammatically unsound?
Well, I think what you need it to say is the wrongdoers. I mean, that would be the antecedent that you would want. Right?
Sorry. Take all the leaders of the people and execute the offenders.
The offenders. So the antecedent that you would like is the offenders.
Yeah, I'm not really good at grammar. Sorry.
Well, the word that pronoun is referring to, you'd want it to refer to the offenders.
Uh-huh.
So we'd have to find, you'd have to go back a long ways to find that as the antecedent.
Oh, okay, so you're only saying that in my Bible it says offenders, but for you it's just hang them.
It's a pronoun, them. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I will look at that also and check,
all right.
Make sure.
And the second thing is, can we look at the Zimri was the one who was killed, right? Run through?
Yes.
In 14?
Yes.
Can we look at him as a Christ figure? Like one who, you know, we say that Christ took on the sins of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And so then, like, there was Phinehas representing the holy, righteous wrath of God going out and running Christ through on the cross with the spear. And because of that, all the other people that should have died because of this, mm-hmm. they didn't die.
Mm-hmm. Well, there, this event, I don't know that I would describe it that way, seeing Zimri as a Christ-like figure. But this event bears resemblance to Christ's death on the cross, in that atonement came about through the act of one man. There is a similarity there, I think, but I don't know that I would call Zimri a Christ-like figure here.
Yeah, I know that probably sounded really offended.
Yeah, it's more the event. The event bears a resemblance to the cross.
But in a very heretical sounding way, we could almost say that he's kind of a Christ figure.
Well, I don't think it's not picturing it that same way.
Yeah.
It's not that tight an analogy, and I don't think it's intended to be that tight an analogy. It's analogous in that the action of one man brings atonement for a whole people. And that I think is echoed in Christ's death on the cross. One more, and then I'll leave more time next week.
When Balak was trying to curse the Israelites and it backfired, I was just wondering how did he know? Like, was he trying to like send a swarm of locusts down, and then they had a special on chocolate covered locusts, or yeah. How did he know? What was he looking for the curse, and what indications they get that it didn't work? Or do we have any idea?
Well, presumably what he wanted was a curse on the people of Israel such that the Israelites would be rendered weak and vulnerable to attack by the Moabites. And what form that would take, I don't think even he would necessarily know. But to know that they had been cursed, Balaam would have to have said, "You are cursed," to the Israelites. And that doesn't happen. In fact, it's the other way around. Balaam proclaims a blessing on the people of Israel. So
okay, that's where God said, "You will bless." God was actually saying, "You bless them instead of curse them."
Yes.
Okay.
Balaam ends up blessing them rather than cursing them. So the Balak is not going to attack the Israelites under those circumstances. They've just been blessed, not cursed. So he knows that his chances of victory have been eliminated. Thanks.